This is the first day of this April 2018 seven-day session. We'll read from the teachings of the 12th century Chinese Zen master Fuyan. And this is from the book titled Instant Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. Begins. The spiritual body has three kinds of sickness and two kinds of light. When you have passed through each one, only then are you able to sit in peace. In the Heroic Progress Discourse, furthermore, it's a sutra, Buddha explained 50 kinds of meditation sickness. Now I tell you that you need to be free from sickness to attain realization. There is a lengthy footnote about these different kinds of sicknesses, but I think we'll just stick with Fuyan's own teaching, because now he says, in my school, there are only two kinds of sickness. One is to go looking for a donkey riding on the donkey. The other is to be unwilling to dismount once having mounted the donkey. I'm going to switch to a different translation. This is Thomas Cleary, but for this passage, I'm going to turn to Andy Ferguson from his Zen's Chinese Heritage, and here's his translation. I think it's better. Fuyan said, I say there are but two types of sickness. One is to ride a donkey to look for the donkey. The other is riding the donkey and not letting yourself get off of it. Don't you see that riding a donkey to find a donkey is a fatal disease? In other words, searching for enlightenment when we are all inherently enlightened. This old mountain monk is telling you, don't seek it. Clever people understand right where they are. They give up the seeking disease and the crazy thought-pursuing mind. Once you've seen the donkey not allowing yourself to get off, now that is a disease that's most hard to cure. This old monk, mountain monk, is telling you, don't ride it. Don't let the notion of attainment ride you, is really what he's saying. He continues, you are the donkey. The great earth is the donkey. How are you going to ride it? If you continue to ride it, you'll never cure this disease. How can you ride yourself? In other words, if you don't ride it, then all the worlds in the 10 directions are open to you. If you can get rid of both of these diseases at once, then there's nothing left in your mind and you're called a person of the way. What then could trouble you? And then he ends by saying, therefore, Zhao Zhou asked Nan Xuan, what is the way? This is a koan in the Mumonkan, number 19. What is the way? And Nan Xuan answered, everyday mind is the way. Or you could say, just this. This. Stop imagining that there's some other time, some other place. It's this. Let's go back to him saying, this old mountain monk is telling you, don't seek it. In some passages by other Chinese masters, he says, do not strive. So How do we make sense of this? Do not seek, do not strive. Doesn't mean you don't try. Doesn't mean you make no effort and just sit back and hope that awakening will come to you. It means not to self-consciously be grasping at your idea of what enlightenment is. So how do you make an effort without doing that? Well, you concentrate fully on the breath. You question the koan. This is not grasping at an idea of enlightenment. This is becoming one with the practice you're working on. And then he sort of goes off and tells a story about Zhao Zhou. That's the actual Chinese name of the master known in Japan as Joshu. One day Zhao Zhou went to visit Zhu Yao, where he paced back and forth, brandishing his staff from east to west and west to east. Zhu Yao asked, "What are you doing?" Zhao Zhou replied, "Testing the water." Zhu Yao retorted, "I haven't even one drop here. What will you test?" And Zhao Zhou left, leaning on his staff. See how he revealed a bit of an example, really quite able to stand out. Testing the water. Roshi used to use this Japanese phrase, sagadibo, which means putting a stick in the water to see how deep it is. So a lot of that we see in the records, the dialogues of the masters, or master and a monk, putting a stick in the water. See how he responds. And now, he continues, "I always tell you that what is inherent in you is presently active and presently functioning, and need not be sought after, need not be put in order, need not be practiced or proven. All that is required is to trust it once and for all. This saves a lot of energy. This is the most effective way of practicing." This is a wonderful point he's making, that what is inherent in you, this self-nature, this essential mind, is presently active, presently functioning. It's functioning when you are seated on your cushion. It's functioning when you're washing your hands. It's functioning when you're using the toilet. It's functioning when you're eating, when you're walking. That's it. Need not be sought after. Need not be put in order. What could possibly be out of order in the way? All that is required, he says, is to trust it once and for all. Well, this translates into trusting the practice we're working on, the particular specific practice. Trusting mu. Trusting what? Trusting the breath. Everything does become so much simpler and smoother if we can just put ourselves thoroughly, fully into the practice we're working on. It is largely a matter of trust. Another word is faith, but we can use them interchangeably. I think maybe trust is a less loaded word for some people. Trusting just the practice. Or, just put it another way, not trusting anything of the mind. Not trusting any thought you're having. Trusting only the practice you're working on. If you want to see Sesshin fly by, trust only the practice you're working on and not your thoughts. It is hard to find people like this. When my teacher was with his teacher used to say, "This path is a natural subtlety attained by oneself, generally focusing on the existence of innate knowledge." Wisdom, not knowledge, wisdom. When I saw my teacher, I was unable to express this for 10 years. Just because I questioned deeply, I later attained penetrating understanding, and now do not waste any energy at all. That's that phrase again, not wasting energy. In the previous paragraph, he said, this trusting of the practice saves a lot of energy. This is a phrase that you see quite a bit in Chinese texts, not wasting energy, saving energy. It becomes more meaningful as Sesshin goes on. Just because I questioned deeply, I later attained penetrating understanding. For people who find that the questioning of their koan is sort of scattershot, is uneven, is elusive, you needn't worry about that as long as you're concentrating completely on the koan. And eventually, if you maintain that degree of absorption, then the questioning will come. Here's another letter. Many are those who have seen but can do nothing about it. Once you have seen, why can't you do anything about it? Just because of not discerning. That is why you are helpless. If you see and discern, then you can do something about it. This is not so easy for me to interpret. My best guess would be when he says many are those who have seen but can do nothing about it, it could be who have seen into their true nature but haven't integrated that awakening into their daily life. That's one possibility. Or another is people who have seen into their shortcomings but haven't yet got to the point where they can overcome these habitual conditioning. Maybe that's the more likely one, because when he says if you see and discern, that is, see through this habit energy, see the emptiness of it, then you can do something about it. And it's not a problem in the same way. Once we have truly seen through the illusory nature of even of these stubborn habits we have, these emotional thought habits. He continues, nevertheless, if you expect to understand as soon as you are inspired to practice Zen, well, who wouldn't like that? It's just that you have no way in, and you cannot force understanding. Failing to mesh with it in every situation, missing the connection at every point, you cannot get it by exertion of force. It's another fundamental principle that many of us have to find through trial and error. You cannot force understanding. You cannot get it by exertion of force. You don't need force to concentrate fully on the practice. It's not you're not forcing anything. And you sure don't need force to question. Whatever you are doing 24 hours a day in all your various activities, there is something that transcends the Buddhas and Zen masters. But as soon as you want to understand it, it's not there. It's not really there. As soon as you try to gather your attention on it, you have already turned away from it. That is why I say you see but cannot do anything about it. This reminds me of a koan in the Blue Cliff Record, where in number 86, where a Zen master Yunmen says, it's not there. It's in the Affirming Faith in Mind. Within light there is darkness, but do not try to understand that darkness. Does this mean that you will realize it if you do not aim the mind and do not develop intellectual understanding? Far from it. You will fail even more seriously to realize it. Even understanding does not get it, much less not understanding. So I think what he's saying is when we concentrate on, let's use the koan, when we're concentrating on a koan, it seems to elude us. It seems to be inconstant. It seems to get away from us. Until a certain point, it's not steady. But then he says, we also can't not aim the mind, our attention, at the koan. That would be to fail even more seriously to realize it. So we direct our attention as thoroughly, as completely as possible to the practice we're working on, knowing that until a certain point, it does seem to get away from us, but we still make the effort to keep returning our attention to it, even though it eludes us. If people with potential for enlightenment, well, that would be everyone, are willing to see in this way, they must investigate most deeply and examine most closely. All of a sudden, they will gain mastery of it and have no further doubt. The reason you do not understand is just because you are taken away by random thoughts 24 hours a day. Since you want to learn business, he must be addressing a businessman. Since you want to learn business, you fall in love with things you see and fondly pursue things you read. Over time, you get continuously involved. How can you manage to work on enlightenment then? And then he pursues this theme. He says, generally speaking, there are appropriate times for those who study business. I'm not sure he means business as we mean business, the business of making money. Well, maybe that is what he means, but in any field, any kind of field of where our worldly, maybe that's what he means, in worldly pursuits. But let's use his word, the words of the translator here. Over the age of 30, it's better not to study because it will be hard to learn even if you do, and it will also be of dubious value. Now, this sounds rather bleak. Although I do think of learning a language, a foreign language, after the age of 30, they say it gets harder and harder. But let's just play this out. Over the age of 30, it's better not to study because it will be hard to learn even if you do. If you have taken care of your own business, on the other hand, that is the business of the self, that is practice, then you will still be able to learn through study because you have been transformed. But if you have done with your own business, that is, if you have realized the self nature, why would you study? Well, you would if you had to make money and raise a family and so forth. If you are 20 years of age or thereabouts, you can still study, but if you are spiritually sharp and intent on the matter of life and death, you won't study anything else. And then there is a footnote that may flesh this out a bit. The translator says, the statements about learning business may require some clarification. One of the main ideas that is that it is better to learn professional skills when young so that you may have more freedom for other interests later on. Another idea is that too much interest in business can inhibit this freedom. Yet another is that after enlightenment, things can often be mastered without having to be learned. People in the East often studied Zen to improve their skills in arts, crafts, writing, government, soldiering, and other businesses, even to the extent that secondary purposes crowded out the original essence of Zen. I think Foyan here may have the best intentions, but we can too easily be misled if we're thinking about ages of when we can do things and when we can't do things. I think Foyan might not make these blanket statements if he saw how much one can accomplish a more advanced age. And even aside from accomplishing, becoming, say, fluent in a foreign language, there is great benefit to studying a foreign language, for example, in terms of keeping the mind sharp and having less memory loss. There's a lot of research that is available to us that was not available to Foyan. But I think the point here is, I think his main point is that there is great advantage to practicing seriously when you're young. The older we get, the more likely we can run into physical problems. And also, I suppose, the more set we become in our notions about ourself and others, the more the mind tends to get stuck in concepts about life and self and other. But what does it matter if, let's say, you're 40 or 50 or 60, when you come to this path and you have the possibility of, through daily practice, of changing your life, changing the way you experience life, others, relationships, work? why would you not want to practice? It doesn't matter. However old we happen to be, that's the time to start. It's a great, great gift to encounter the Dharma even at an advanced age. It makes everything easier going forth from that age, dealing with the stress of physical and mental decline. But back to Foyan's words, whenever you seek Zen, furthermore, your mind ground must be even and straight, and your mind and speech must be in accord. Since your mind and speech are straightforward, your states are thus consistent from start to finish without any petty details. I think the takeaway of this paragraph is with the help of practice, to notice when the mind is divided and to get more fully into whatever it is we're doing, so the mind functions straight ahead, straightforward, that's what he means, without vacillating, without wobbling. That's what thoughts do to us when we're caught in thoughts. It's uncertainty, doubt. And contrary, when the mind is single-minded, no-minded, that's when we can act, respond most effectively in all situations. Here's another letter. Sometimes when I question students, they say they do not know or understand. They just say they eat when hungry and sleep when tired. What redemption is there in such talk? You even say you are not cognizant of whether the month is long or short and do not care whether it is a leap year. Who understands this affair of yours? So he's here criticizing monks who learn this sort of Zen talk of just responding, I don't know, or this famous saying, I eat when hungry and I sleep when tired. Oh, good for you. He continues, now I ask you, how do you explain the logic of not knowing? You hear others say this, so you say it yourselves. But have you ever understood that principle of not knowing? And then he answers for us. An ancient said, not knowing means nothing is not known, nowhere not reached. This is called unknowing, so that you people today may reach that unknown state. This is the realm of the sages. How could it be like the blindness and non-understanding that people today call not knowing? Roshi Kapo used to say, if you know, say you know. If you don't know, say you don't know. So this not knowing, posing like Bodhidharma, this can of course be taken too far. In our work, There are times, plenty of times, when we need to know. It's our job to have learned something or know the answers to things. You can't just take refuge in this old saying. And if he ends by saying, if you go on like this, always declaring you don't know and are not concerned, how will you communicate if someone questions you? There might be no one to continue on the road of Zen. It won't do to be like this. Make your choice carefully. It's another letter. It begins with Foyan quoting the third ancestor of Zen. That's the Sungsan, the author of Affirming Faith and Mind. So this is from Affirming Faith and Mind. Don't seek reality, just put a stop to opinions. I think in our chanting version of this, we say, just let those fond opinions go. He also said, as soon as there are judgments of right and wrong, the mind is lost in a flurry. These sayings teach you people of today what to work on. When you read his saying, don't seek reality, you say there is no further need to seek. This means you are still entertaining opinions are in a flurry of judgments. After all, you have not reached a state of mind where there is no seeking and are just making up an opinionated interpretation. So this is sort of the same, along the same vein of what the previous letter we read, of just spouting Zen talk. People who study Zen nowadays are like this, reading a transformative saying and reaching an insight into the words. They then try to apply it to all sayings, thinking they are all the same. Keeping this in their hearts, they think of it as their own attainment. Far from realizing they have lost their minds by entertaining an opinionated understanding, they cling to it and will not let go. What ignoramuses! The point is, of course, that everything depends on the understanding behind the words. Zhao Zhou, Joshu, famously said, when a person of understanding speaks a false doctrine, it becomes true. When a person of no understanding speaks a true doctrine, it becomes false. This is the whole point of Zen practice, is to not be attached to words, concepts. This is what the koans, subsequent to one's first koan, this is what the koans remind us again and again and again, to see through the words, the ideas, the concepts. Would you like to attain a state of mind where you seek nothing? Just do not conceive all sorts of opinions and views. This non-seeking does not mean blanking out and ignoring everything. In everyday life, 24 hours a day, when there is unclarity in the immediate situation, it is generally because the opinionated mind is grasping and rejecting. How can you get to know the non-discriminatory mind then? Thus, when an ancient sage was asked if the created and the uncreated are different, he said they are not. Sky and earth, rivers and seas, wind and clouds, grasses and trees, birds and beasts, people and things living and dying, changing right before our eyes, are all called created forms. The uncreated way is silent and unmoving. The indescribable and unnameable is called uncreated. How can there be no difference? So he's talking about the realm of differentiation and the realm of non-differentiation. And this ancient sage that Foyan quotes says, they're not different. And then he is playing with us. He's saying, look at all these things, these everywhere, all the different things, different names and forms. How can there be no difference? Of course, he's saying this to invite us to see through this dualism of differentiation and non-differentiation. Then he quotes the master Yong Jia. The true nature of ignorance is the very nature of enlightenment. The empty body of illusions and projections is the very body of realities. And then Foyan says, these two are each distinct. How do you understand the logic of identity? You have to experience the mind without seeking. Then they will integrate and you will get to be trouble-free. As a phrase I ran across recently talking about this distinction between the realm of the conditioned and that of the unconditioned, the relative and the absolute. Here's the phrase, two horns, one ox. Like an artist drawing all sorts of pictures, both pretty and ugly, the mind depicts forms, feelings, perceptions, abstract patterns, and consciousnesses. It depicts human societies and paradises. Think of the world of art, and including religious art, paradises, hells. When it is drawing these pictures, it does not borrow the power of another. There is no discrimination between the artist and the artwork. It is because of not realizing this that you conceive various opinions, having views of yourself and views of other people, creating your own fair and foul. So, this is a core theme of the various sutras, especially the Lankavatara Sutra, that everything, every perception we have is the projection of our own mind. We see this more clearly than ever in this whole matter of fake news, of false news, where people believe the most fantastic things, and they create these realities that aren't real at all. And he says, so it is said, an artist draws a picture of hell with countless sorts of hideous forms. On setting aside the brush to look it over, it's bone-chilling, really hair-raising. That's the end of the saying that he just quoted. And then he says, but if you know it's a drawing, what is there to fear? That is, if we see all of the play of phenomena in the world, political phenomena, suffering, every kind of phenomena, if we see it as just phenomena, then our perspective is radically different. We are not troubled by it, at least to the same degree. We can have a genuine concern about, say, the fate of the world as we know it, say, through climate change. And yet there is this element of detachment, not indifference, but detachment when we realize that it all is all the world of appearances. He continues, in olden times, when people had clearly realized this, it became evident in all situations. Once when the great teacher Xuanzha was cutting down a tree, a tiger bounded out of the woods. The teacher's companion says, "It's a tiger." The teacher scolded him and said, "It's a tiger for you." Another time, when he saw a seeker performing prostrations, Xuanzha said, "It is because of the self that one can bow to the other." These expedients are in profound accord with the intent of Buddha. The great teacher Fa Yen, and not to be confused with the author of this book, Fo Yan, the great teacher Fa Yen once pointed to a dog right in front of him and said, "An engraving." When you look at this, do not look to the dog itself for clarification. You must see it in your own experience before you can get it. Only then will you understand that saying, "As soon as there are judgments of right and wrong, you lose your mind in a flurry," only then will you understand that saying. "I hope you get the point," he says at the very end. We've come to the end of this letter, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I bow to the brave,
endless blind passions,
I bow to above root,
Dharma gates beyond measure,
I bow to penetrate
the great way of Buddha,
I bow to attain.
All beings without number,
I bow to liberate
endless blind passions,
I bow to uproot
Dharma gates beyond measure,
I bow to penetrate
the great way of Buddha,
I bow to attain.
All beings without number,
I bow to liberate
endless blind passions,
I bow to uproot
darkness beyond measure,
I bow to penetrate
the great way of Buddha,
I bow to attain.